Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and one that he stated was the previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I got to tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we got to do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment. Hi there, I'm Carol Jurgensen, Chief, a.k.a. Carol the Coach, and I am very, very happy to be here with you today. We're just getting so much good feedback about this show, and we're hearing that it's really helping you to feel safe, to get good information that you absolutely know is partner sensitive. And, you know, unfortunately, many times what I know to be true is that there are lots of therapists out there that want to help, but they don't know what they don't know, so they don't know how to help. Not really. You know, they dismiss the trauma and the pain, or they encourage you to kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and just forgive him. And although we are not an organization that believes that you can't be happy with a recovering sex addict, we believe that sexual addiction recovery is possible. We want to keep you together if that's what you want. But we also know that not every couple can make it. And when they can't, that becoming separated with dignity and integrity is always the best choice. And so we really appreciate the fact that it is important in so many ways to help you navigate this crisis and then help you figure out what you're going to do next. And that in itself can be very, very tough because truly your brain goes offline. You can't really figure it out. And so you just do the best you can. And when you're working with an AppSats clinician or a coach, they have studied how to expedite this for you, by making you feel safe and by helping you grieve and helping you restore your own sense of sanity. So I am super glad that I can be part of that organization. And I know I sound like I'm a walking commercial for them because I am. I mean, they're the finest partner-sensitive organization in the world. Now, speaking of partners, I'm actually working with a partner and the addict, and the addict is a woman. And I was talking to her today, and she was going into the fact that they were married and they got a divorce, and they started seeing each other again, and she relapsed. And he discovered this in August of last year. And they found me because of the podcast and the book and stuff. They found me about 6 weeks ago. And we all decided that I should work with her first. So, in other words, the partner, we'll call him Tom. Tom said, you know what? I think she's on the right road. I'm not sure whether I can trust her again. He said all this stuff in front of her. Why don't you go ahead and work with her? I do believe she could use a little more empathy and better communication skills. And you can help her to help me feel safe. So I said, okay. So we were talking today, and I did, by the way, get permission to talk about this with you because I was really, really, really impressed. And she made some sort of comment about, yeah, I didn't really show much empathy last night. And it had turned out that she had had a really exhausting day at work where she got to advocate for a whole section of her work, people that needed to be advocated for. And she did a really, really nice job of it, but she found that it really depleted her. I mean, it was hard stuff. And she called Tom during the day, and she said, hey, Tom, I just wanted you to know that I really had a good day. I really feel like I made a difference, you know, and just really shared her experience. And he said, that's great. And I can't remember if it was then, I think it was then, that she intimated that when she got home and got all settled in, she actually wanted to know if he wanted to get physical. I'm just kind of making this kid-friendly, if you will. So he said, yes, absolutely. And so she got home, and she was still on a high, and she talked to Tom about it. And Tom was really engaging and was really proud of her. And they really felt close, and he offered to rub her head as she laid her head in his lap. Well, maybe you can imagine what happened, but she fell asleep. And I don't know if she put herself to bed or just fell asleep on the couch, but regardless, when she woke up, he was looking at his phone. He was kind of going through Facebook or his emails or something. And she said, oh my gosh, I fell asleep. I'm so sorry we didn't have time to be together. And he was disgruntled. He was hurt. He was angry because it was another broken promise. And so she felt like she didn't use empathy because she didn't see that coming ahead of time. She didn't realize how exhausted she would be. And she knows that broken promises are a trigger because when she was acting out, she would break promises all the time. And so he was really triggered. He was really mad. And so the first thing that happened was that she stayed up to talk to him about it. That was step number one, very positive. The second thing, although she knew she would get turned down, she offered to be close and intimate right then and there, even though it was like 2 a.m. And she goes, I knew there was no way he's going to want to do that, but I thought I'd offer anyway. And I said, why'd you do that? And she said, well, because I love him, and I didn't want to hurt him, and I didn't want him to be disappointed. And even though I knew he was mad at me, so he wasn't going to want to be close, I still wanted him to know that I wanted him. And that was really important for her, because the truth of the matter is he's one of 7 kids and the youngest, and he really never felt valued or appreciated, you know, coming from that large of a family. And so when she did not stay awake to be with him, it triggered maybe some previous trauma from being a child, what we call little T trauma. Okay, so now she's done 2 positive things from my eyes. She has talked about it with him, and she's offered to be close. He, of course, declined. And she said, well, can I at least rub your back? So that was positive number three. She wanted to at least rub his back, which most people will want, even if they're mad. Well, she scored. He did. And they both fell asleep. The next morning, she did positive number four by saying, hey, can we talk about what happened last night? I want to acknowledge, she like used my empathy tips. I want to acknowledge that that had to make you feel really lonely and sad that I didn't stay up. And I just want you to know that I know that. And he said, yeah, it did. It really did. And so then she asked for what we call a behavioral request. John Gottman talks about this in therapy. She asked, can I have a do-over? I wouldn't blame you if you said no, but do you mind if I have a do-over and we make tonight your special night? I'll cook something nice. We'll watch a movie you want to watch. We'll spend time together. And just do a do-over from the other night. She goes, I hate to tell you that I'm well rested, because I'm really not. She had stayed up and thought about how she could have made things better for about 3 hours after he fell asleep. I know I said they both fell asleep, but she actually stayed awake and really took responsibility within herself. And obviously the next day, this morning, she was taking responsibility again. That's always good. I know you partners want your recovering sex addicts to take responsibility for when they let you down. So she did that. And then I'm just looking at my paperwork right now. She got a buy-in, and later on he came up to her and he said, you know what, why don't we also carve out some time this weekend to go to your favorite winery that you've never been to, but it actually has her favorite wine. And let's explore it. Let's just do a road trip and go to see your favorite winery and just make it a day. And she felt so relieved because he was willing to let his guard down and work at closeness again. So sometimes you have to spoon feed the recovering sex addict, your husband, and let him know what it is you need. But I know that most women, boy, they hate that. They don't want to spoon feed. They want their husbands to know. They want this. They want to know that their sex addicts can figure it out on their own. But I'm here to tell you, I've been working with couples for 40 years. Okay, 39. And in normal situations, let alone where sexual and partner betrayal has occurred, there is no reading of the mind. Men especially need to be spoon-fed. They need to hear from you what you need. And so don't hesitate to let them know. I know it puts you at risk, because if you let him know and then he doesn't do it, it's a double betrayal, right? But it really is important for the sanctity of your relationship to spell it out, sometimes over and over and over again, because I don't know what it is, but people love repetition, and men especially love repetition. So that's my tip for the day. You know, I gave her an exercise, and I'd love to give it to you, too. I asked her to come up with 50 things that she liked about herself, 50 personality strengths that were not roles. They were things that she appreciated about herself, because she really is making good changes. And, you know, she shared with me, I really work hard at trying, I work hard at making him feel special. And she told me of a couple of things she does. She just recently made 25 signs and put some clip art on it. And, you know, things like, I appreciate you. You're the greatest. I really like you.
I love the way you hug me, you know, those kinds of things. And then she puts post-it notes around on the mirror, in the refrigerator, on a bottle of wine, just letting him know that he means something special to her. She says he's an affirmation guy and she's a quality time person. So that's the good news, is that she is constantly working on making him feel appreciated. And what she said to me was, well, Carol, you told me at some point that partners need to feel special and Tom needs to be treated like a king. And I have to admit, I didn't remember saying that. But the bottom line is, anytime you can acknowledge, validate, and appreciate your partner, things will go better. So that's what I've got to say about that. Now today we have a really special guest. She's going to be talking about how to heal from sexual betrayal. And we both know that there is no greater pain than partner betrayal. And this is a woman that works with couples. She's a CSAT, so she works, which for anybody who's new to the program, CSAT is a certified sexual addictions therapist. She works with the sex addict, and she works with the partner to make her feel safe. And when she does that, you know, she's got the capability of making great changes in the life of the coupleship. And she's going to be talking about what tips and tools she uses, and she's going to talk about the difference between porn addiction and infidelity. And it's just nice to get another therapist take on what they see as working in the field of partner betrayal. I am talking about Jennifer Josie, who works for Intuitive Pathways Recovery. And she's made it her mission to really help the dyad and the triad make the changes that they need to make. So I'm excited to have her on. And, you know, I know that there are probably questions you have that you would like for us to answer. So let me just encourage you, if you have a question that you'd like us to answer on the show, feel free to send me an email. And that would be to carol@carolthecoach.com. Because we definitely want to help you get your needs met in all sorts of healthy ways. It's so important to do that and to be available and to be a resource for you. So I can't encourage you enough to use this show to get your needs met. And actually, I know that that happens because I talk to a lot of people who say, hey, we've heard you on the show and we looked up that resource. We are going to make sure that we follow through with the advice that you're giving us. So, I'm wondering, you know, as I work with partners, which phase of recovery are you in? Are you still working on feeling safe? Are you working on grief? Are you working on what part of partner betrayal do you believe you're in? Are you in the third phase? Are you actually feeling some post-traumatic growth? Are you feeling like you've got this now? So, I would like to know, I'd love to be able to take a survey You know, as a matter of fact, I think I might do that. I think we may put together a survey and get your feelings about where you're at in your own recovery and how'd you get there. Who helped you with safety and stabilization? Who worked with you on grieving? What is going on? Okay. We really care about what you're thinking and feeling. So please know that. Okay. I am going to be taking a break. We're going to take a commercial, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Jennifer. Okay. Well, we are seemingly taking a break. I'm not really quite sure what's going on. Here we go.
Carol Jurgensen Sheep, a.k.a. Carol the Coach, is available to coach you through the trauma that you're experiencing as a result of being a partner of a sex addict. She is a certified clinical partner specialist trained by APSAP, the Association of Partners of Sexual Addicts Trauma Specialists, to help you navigate through the trauma. APSAP is the only organization designated to help partners and their spouses find safety in an unsafe situation. She will also coach you and your spouse to set up healthy communication, empathy, and boundaries that will create safety and stabilization after discovery. Carol is a certified sexual addiction specialist, so she can work with your spouse to create the tools to assist him in finding true recovery. She uses Zoom to provide the necessary consultation to get you through this crisis. For more information, go to her website, www.sexhelpwithcaroldecoach.com, or email her directly at carol@caroldecoach.com.
You know, I have never played that commercial, but I always use that. I want to use a commercial when we're having some technical difficulties. So Jennifer is trying to call into the show, and I just sent her a second number to call. So I'm just really happy that hopefully she will be able to call in and we can figure out, where'd she get that number and how? Okay. One of the things that I believe to be true is that when you're working on the air and you're working with the internet, it's so important for you to have a backup plan. This is oftentimes a gift to be able to have this kind of technology, but it can really kind of set you up too. So I am waiting for her to call in. And I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say. In the meantime, I'm going to give you a tip. You know, last week when I talked about the fact that it's really important for you to look at life and ask yourself, what does it have to teach you or what can you learn from it? Kind of takes you out of that victim state and puts you in a place where, you know, you can feel empowered. Well, I know that we can get you to a place whereby you're empowered through information and education. That's why so much of what we do at APSAP is to explain, what is that? How does that work? What makes it different? You know, I really know and believe that we can always learn something from any situation. And that's what Jennifer Josie is here to talk to us about today. You know, what are the issues that she deals with clients and couples? And so, Jennifer, I'm so glad we've gotten you the right number so that you could call in. I'm glad number two worked. How are you today?
I'm great. Hi, Carol. Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Well,
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I am doing fine too. I was really impressed with the fact that you work like I do with a partner, with the sex addict, and with the coupleship if they want that. Tell me a little bit about how did you make that decision to work with all three?
That's a good question. It just evolved over time. I was working at a counseling center in town here, and I was running sex addict group, therapy groups, and then it evolved into, well, the sex addict in this group wants me to see his wife, and I was like, oh, okay, well, and then I started seeing the partner, and then I I got my certification in sex addiction therapy, so I'm a CSAT, so I did that first, sorry, I forgot that step there, important one, and so I did the groups for partners and actually for sex addicts, and then I decided while I was in my internship that I really wanted to work with couples. So it kind of evolved over time and took some time, but anyway, that's kind of how it transformed. I was watching the owner or my boss at the time work with the addict and then with the partners as well. And I learned from her and I learned from the CSAT training. So, and I've always had a passion for working with couples. I knew that even before I had received my licensures or anything like that, I just knew I wanted to focus on the coupleship, the relationship. So it's very fulfilling and something I'm very passionate about.
Well, I can understand that. And obviously, we've both worked in the field long enough that if you're working with couples, you're going to at least be working with infidelity, and then, of course, you might be working with sexual addiction, and you have made that choice. So I'm curious, how would you define infidelity? Because that's different than sexual addiction.
Right, right, it is. So how I consider or how I define infidelity is when one partner is being unfaithful to their spouse, and infidelity really can, I think, show up in different ways in relationships. It can happen through internet pornography. It can happen through hiring escorts or prostitutes. It can happen through even emotional affairs. And just to clarify a little bit about what an emotional affair is it's when a person not only, puts emotional energy outside their committed relationship, but they also receive emotional support and companionship from the new relationship. And as a result of that, they oftentimes feel closer to the new relationship rather than the committed partner. So that's a little information about emotional affairs. And also, infidelity happens in all types of relationships, same-sex affairs. Oftentimes in same-sex affairs, it can be rationalized, oh, well, if a man's having sex with a man, then, oh, it's no big deal. I'm not really cheating on my wife with another woman. So it's okay, you know, but it also can happen in male-female relationships. So basically, it's the unfaithful person in this talk will be referred to as a sex addict because that's my area of expertise and training. So just a little side note there, but infidelity, I really believe, is breaking the sacred trust that's built in a relationship when intimate, important secrets are kept from your primary romantic partner.
Wow, that's a good definition. And so, you know, what I know is that for me, infidelity is exactly what you said, but infidelity is not necessarily compulsive. It can be an experience that occurred once or twice in the lifetime of a marriage or an affair partner that lasted 3 years, but it's not compulsive. Mm-hmm. The sex addict, male or female, can stop. They aren't under the control of that compulsion. And you decided to go and learn about sex addiction. So what made you make the leap?
Wow, that's a good question. I had a lot of experience with sex addiction in my life. I grew up in a family with a sex addict, actually multiple sex addicts in my family, and then also I've chosen a lot of sex addicts, and I am a recovering sex addict, so it just seemed like a natural fit. Like, I just understood it on so many levels personally and then also now professionally, so it just was kind of a no-brainer to me in the sense that it was a natural progression, I guess, for being professional in this area. So,
well, yes, I think when you've got that experience and you've had that background, that really does make a difference in what you choose to study. I mean, I love the old adage that, you know, we teach what we need to learn. So tell me a little bit about the difference that you believe between porn addiction and sex addiction with people, you know, massage parlors, prostitutes, affair partners, blah, blah. Do you see a difference?
Between, can you repeat the question? I'm sorry. It's between
porn addiction.
I'm sorry.
And other forms of sex addiction.
Okay. So, well, really, as far as the impact goes, I think that, it's shown that the impact and turmoil created on the spouse from internet sex or in-flesh sex really is, it's not different. I mean, it shows that, you know, whether someone's watching pornography or webcams or hiring escorts or prostitutes or visiting massage parlors, all have the same emotional impact on each other. So it's the lying and the deceiving, the walling off emotionally and breaking the relational trust that's the most painful for partners. So I think, you know, the pornography and the in-flesh, you know, sexual experiences really have about the same effect. It is the emotional betrayal for partners that's much more painful than the physical betrayal. So if you're acting out sexually and keeping it a secret, or your partner knows about it but it's uncomfortable, I consider that, you know, cheating. So, but acting out sexually is more about lies and secrets you've kept rather than the specific behavior he or she's engaged in. Hopefully that's answering your question.
Yeah. So when you're working with sex addicts, what kinds of, I don't want to be so cliche and say tips or tools, but what do you do with a sex addict who has been in relationship and caused partner betrayal?
Right. Well, there's quite, it's hard to narrow down, but there are lots of tools I recommend. So let's see. What can we do? What are some of the important tips, so to speak, as you said? The first thing I'll say is for the sex addict, they really need outside help, like as soon as possible. And in my experience, that looks like therapy and 12-step recovery. I know there's other potential sources of help that people can utilize, such as going to their church or other support communities. But my preference is recommending therapy coupled with 12-step recovery. And the second recommendation I'd give to the addict is the person needs to understand and practice rigorous honesty and accountability. And this can't be done through outside. I'm sorry, this can be done through outside support. And commonly in therapy, the partner and the addict will go through formal therapeutic disclosure of the addict's acting out behavior. And I will state that I highly recommend disclosure not be done without a very skilled professional or certified sex addiction therapist. However, formal disclosure can establish a baseline of trust in the relationship again, if it's done properly. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm 100%. Yeah, you know, APSATS believes that once an addict has at least 90 days of good recovery under his belt, and, you know, he's going to meetings or he's got a mentor or a sponsor, he's developing that fellowship, he's doing that work, then you can begin that therapeutic formal disclosure. And like you said, that's not for this, for the average person. You really need to be trained in this kind of disclosure. And so I think it really benefits the therapist, I'm sorry, the addict and the partner each to have their own therapist to coordinate that.
Uh-huh.
Now,
sure.
Do you have a certain amount of time that you like for the addict to be in good recovery before he or she starts that disclosure process?
That's a good question. Well, with the counseling center that I was working on in before I went into private practice, what we typically wanted, and this is what I practice now, is but what we typically wanted was that the sex addict had at least 90 days of celibacy and, you know, and also recovery from his or her bottom line behaviors. And so typically once they hit the 90 days, then I think, and sometimes some of the clients need 180 days. So it varies, but oftentimes after the 90 or 180 days, again, depending on the person and how many years they've been acting out and how much trauma they've had and et cetera, that then we can start to begin the process of working on the disclosure. So I would recommend at least 90 days, but sometimes in certain situations it's longer. So
yeah, Jennifer, I'm glad you said that, because you're right. Not, you know, we can never do a one size fits all, and it really depends on what's going on for the coupleship, what's going on for the sex addict, and what mm-hmm. they both want. I mean, I recently had a woman that said, I was all gung-ho for disclosure, but what I believe in my gut, my husband needs is more recovery. He needs more recovery because mm-hmm. I know he has trouble focusing, and I'm afraid if he starts focusing on that disclosure, he won't have the skills to do both of those processes. So she said, I'm willing to wait another 3 months. And I felt like that was a partner who was really using her judgment. You know, and that can mm-hmm. keep her safe when she can feel like he's really working hard on his own personal recovery. And, you know, I've heard you talk a little bit about the 12-step recovery. Now, I got a question for you. What 12-step recovery are you referencing? Because there are so many. What are you referencing?
Sure. So typically what I reference is Sex Addicts Anonymous, which is also known as SAA. So, you know, in my training, sex addiction is a real disease. There have been several groups, though, that have formed to handle sex addiction, and they are employing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So sex addiction is based on, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous framework. So these groups focus specifically on sex addiction in place of alcoholism or alcohol. And you can, as far as finding more information about these groups, I think you can talk to, if you're in therapy, you could talk to your therapist, or you could search on the internet for Sex Addicts Anonymous, which is also SAA, or Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, which is known as SLAA. And there's also another group in some areas called Sexaholics, and that's also the acronym is SA, and that's also utilized. But all of those groups, I think, provide the needed help and guidance for the addict. It couples really well with therapy, I think, at least in my practice it does, so.
Yeah, me too. I have 10 recovery tools that I want a sex addict to participate in. at least 8 out of 10, and the first 5 have to do with, you know, 12-step meetings and groups. And they, for me, they are having a sponsor, and if you don't see anybody that you want as your sponsor, at least get a temporary. And then 2, going to meetings and deciding how many meetings do you need a week. I mean, I've got guys that are doing 90 meetings in 90 days, and then I've got guys that really mm-hmm. feel like 2 meetings a week are enough. So that's always a customized individual decision. The third thing I promote is that they do the 12-step reading. If it's SAA, they read the Green Book. If it's SA, they read the White Book. If it's Every Man's Battle, they read that book. And then obviously do the work, you know, the actual 12-step work. I'm appalled when I meet a man who says, yeah, I've been in recovery 3 years, and I'll go, oh, how many meetings are you going to? And he says, oh, I'm going to 3 a week. And I go, well, that's great. How many times have you been through the steps? And they go, oh, I've never even started the steps. Oh, gosh.
Oh,
and, you know, that's where the real magic occurs, is when you work your steps.
Right.
And
absolutely.
So do you find that to be true, Jennifer? Have you met men that have never started the actual 12-step work, even though they go to 12-step meetings?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost like they come and they audit. They come, they kind of just sit in the room, listen, and then they leave. Oh, so that means I have really good recovery now. However, you know, if they come into therapy and they're working with me at least, I'll probably find that they're still acting out in some way. I mean, it may not be the bottom line behaviors or inner circle behaviors that originally brought them in, but it could be, you know, emotional affairs, as I mentioned earlier, or it could be something a little more subtle. Or even if it's not acting out behaviors like that, it could be that they're rampant in their character defects, you know, because working through the 12 steps is a big part of it is looking at our, you know, our character defects and what, you know, kind of interfere with or interrupt our relationships. And so when someone's not doing the steps that, and they've been in for 3 years, wow, that would really concern me. I would be like, you know, you really need some individual therapy, I think, to maybe reinforce the tools of the program so that, you know, he gets extra support around that and is like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. You know, this is why it's a good idea, because it's still impacting my life in this way or that way, you know? So I definitely have seen that, and it's always a little bit of a red flag or yellow flag for me. Like,
You know, I agree with you exactly, and you named it and claimed it when you said that they need some more solid individual work with a CSAT, a Certified Sexual Addictions Therapist, or an APSATS. You know, there are several of
sure,
us
yeah.
in the APSATS community that work with sex addicts, I being one of them. Now, I'm a CSAT too, but let me ask you, because so many of our listening audience are in coupleship and they're figuring out how they can feel better. So would you tell me, what do you think is some of the most important things that a sex addict can do to repair the trust in his or her relationship?
That's a good question. So let's see. In most cases, I think recovering from infidelity cannot be done alone. And so whether it be the sex addict or the partner, I mean, I know I'm focusing on the sex addict here, but both need outside help. I can't repeat that enough. So the sex addict really needs outside help and to go through this whole process. And the process is a life change in a lot of ways. And I've learned in my experience that the sex addict can gain help through, as I said, therapy and 12-step recovery. And with this, the sex addict can begin to look at his or her part, take responsibility for his or her actions, which have very likely harmed the partner, is able to be rigorously honest and vulnerable with their spouse. And the addict also, I think, needs to be willing to accept the consequences of his or her behavior, be able to tolerate very hard emotions and face reality. So I think, you know, at least, you know, as I said earlier, I'm a recovering sex addict, and so I'm also a betrayed partner. But all of the things I just listed when I was newly sober, I mean, that definitely had to be a serious life change, because I was isolated. I was dishonest about everything. I mean, these tools I was able to pick up quickly, and they've really, really worked for me, turned my life around. And I've seen with the couples and the addicts that I've worked with, it's been true. You know, if they're able to take responsibility for themselves and their behaviors and all the other items I listed, there's a really, really good chance that things will begin to heal, and that they're on the path towards healing the breach of trust in their relationship.
Yeah, good point. And again, you coming from so many different perspectives is really makes you a valuable resource, because you get it. So now we've talked about sex addiction. What about the partner? What does the shock of betrayal look like for the partners that you work with?
Mm-hmm. So let's see. I would say that the partners who learn of their spouse cheating would say typically experience extreme stress and anxiety, symptoms that are very similar to, if not specifically, post-traumatic stress disorder, which is also known as PTSD. So, and PTSD is a very serious, potentially life-threatening problem. It's a psychological reaction to a traumatic event, whether they've actually witnessed it or experienced it. So oftentimes, I guess it depends on the partner's experience. But the symptoms for the partner when they have discovery oftentimes result in nightmares, sleep disturbances, you know, hypervigilance, or, you know, emotional distress, and also powerful mood swings, you know, going from extremely angry to wanting to connect, to being afraid, to being really sad. So it can be really like an emotional roller coaster for quite a while for the partner. So, you know, and all these responses are very normal to react with the pain and the hurt that the addicts caused. So, you know, the partner really needs, again, outside help and support. And the discovery shock, which I like to call it, is such a universal reaction. And really, the partner has gotten emotionally body slammed by the new reality of broken trust.
I love that, emotionally body slammed. You know, I oftentimes hear it from partners. It's like they say, it's like I got run over by a car or a bus
yes.
or a truck, and I just keep getting rerun over. And metaphorically, that is how it feels, being body slammed or being run over. So what are some of the most important things that you believe that a partner can do to heal from sexual betrayal?
So I would say in the early stages of discovery, a partner's world has been turned upside down, as we've talked about a little bit. And in many ways, their life has been shattered. You know, their brain is oftentimes in overwhelm, trying to make sense of what's happened, trying to organize, trying to understand all the new information that they've had that doesn't match the way that they have seen their life, have seen their relationship, have seen their family before discovery. So they may spend a lot of days obsessing about what's happened and asking a lot of questions to the addict about, you know, content. And these behaviors are a way for the partner to seek safety, through gathering information. But what I've found is the greatest source of safety isn't really through the questioning, but it's rather through practicing really good self-care through the use of effective boundaries. That's been my experience. And I'd say some healthy self-care practices along with effective boundaries are getting STD tested. I mean, because once you find out the addict has been potentially having unprotected sex, you definitely need STD testing. And then also have safe sex practices if you're choosing to have unprotected sex with the addict after discovery. And that's a must, the protected sex. And then utilizing emotional support with friends, family, in therapy. Those will all be lifelines for the partner to deal with the isolation and the uncertainty that she's experiencing now that she's recovering from the betrayal. And also, I think spending time in nature, reading inspirational books or listening to podcasts like this, you know, can bring a lot of comfort, hope, and relief and peace to the partners. So those are two thoughts. I have one more thought and about that, and that's the partner learning how to protect herself or himself, depending on, you know, the situation. But one of the most basic needs for humans is safety. And so after discovery, safety is shattered. So when you find people you feel safe with, your body and nervous system start to relax. And if you start practicing setting boundaries with people, you will instinctively be protecting yourself when you think something or someone is dangerous or unsafe. And safety is a fundamental human need. You know, we all need safety, and safety is created by the effective use of boundaries, protecting ourselves. And boundaries basically are limits we set for ourselves and for others. So they serve two purposes. They create safety by protecting me from others, or the partner from others, or the, you know, the addict from others. And it also protects other people from boundaryless behavior. So, and then lastly, the second point is they define who we are. They act like a physical fence. This is me and how far I'll go, and this is you and how far you'll go. And so when our boundaries are weak, we're at risk of having our boundaries violated by other people. So, and as a result of that, you won't have an accurate danger filter. And so when situations are actually safe, you may feel unsafe. And you may feel angry too, and that you're being taken advantage of, and that your life is spiraling out of control. And so if we don't know how to ask for our needs and wants to be met, you may be easily manipulated or feel helpless. And lastly, boundaries are not something you do to another person. It's basically something you do for your own self-care. It's for your own well-being, and it's for your own protection. And I think that's a really vital lesson for partners and their healing. At least that's been my experience.
Oh, I 100% agree with you. Let me tell my listening audience, I am talking with Jennifer Josie, and she works at Intuitive Pathways. That's a recovery center, correct?
It is. It is.
And it's
located in Houston.
Oh, it's located in Houston. Okay. And her website, or the website where you can reach her, is www.intuitivepathwaysrecovery.com. And you can email Jennifer at that same address, jennifer@intuitivepathwaysrecovery.com, if you have more questions about her. Jennifer, this has been really informational, and, you know, I really admire the fact that you do this kind of work with all the dyads and the triads and the individual people. Now, I just got one more question for you. You talked about how boundaries are so important for partners. It's one of the best ways to stay in safety and stabilization. What are some mm-hmm. steps the couple can take to repair the broken trust?
Great. Thank you for that. First, I would recommend that the spouse and the addict agree to not make any major decisions while they work on rebuilding the trust and work on healing the relationship. I would suggest that the couple commit to a full year of healing before making a final decision. I know that may seem like a really long time, but the trauma of discovery will die down over that period of time, and we don't want anybody in the coupleship to be making a highly reactive, highly emotional decision about a really, you know, big situation. So that's one of the items that I would recommend. Also, I'd suggest that during the process of healing, that they put their primary emotional needs, they put their needs of support on their family, on their friends, on their therapist, on their people in their support network, rather than on each other. Because each of them has their own feelings and experience to process. And having been hurt so deeply by the betrayal, the partner won't want to rely on the addict for sure. And the lack of trust between the two really prevents the mutual support that they once had. And so I also recommend that whatever you do for the addict, do not reach back out to the former affair partner. And lastly, make an agreement to celibacy. I mean, although this may be a difficult decision for both of them, the truth is the spouse doesn't want it. The spouse doesn't trust you right now, and he or she will not want to be sexual with you when she or he does not trust you. So trust has been destroyed by infidelity, and a basis of trust is needed to be restored before reintegrating sexually. So those are three steps that I would recommend, or three tools I would recommend for couples repairing from betrayal trauma.
Oh, I endorse that too. I just so appreciate, again, the fact that you're helping couples to repair and heal from this. And for our listening audience, where you're already divorced or you're separated or you have no intention on restoring this relationship, we always say at APSATS, and I know Jennifer believes this too, that it really is up to you to make the decision about what's in your best interest. And I know that sometimes you sacrifice your choices for the sake of the family or the children and other loved ones. But really, in making these decisions, ask yourself, what do you think? How do you feel? And what do you know in your gut? And that will help to determine what you need to do. Jennifer Josie, thank you so much for being a guest on our show today. This has been really great.
Thank you so much, Carol, for the opportunity. I really appreciate it and appreciate all your questions and inquisitiveness. That's great. And I'm glad to be of service.
All right. You take care and keep me posted. If you're doing any other projects or programs, I want to hear about it so we can tell our APSATS community.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Carol, and you take care as well.
All right. So again, that was Jennifer Josie, and she can be found at intuitivepathwaysrecovery.com. And obviously has a wealth of knowledge. And as I say at the end of every show, hey, there is only going to be one of you at all times, so I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. And that means with intentional self-care. We'll catch you next week for more Betrayal Recovery Radio. You make it a good one. And we'll talk soon.
For more information, go to APSATS.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.